So let me just, I'll just write down something that we ended off with. Oh, right, that's right. Okay. Okay, so we're going to hopefully finish up Fermi liquid theory efficiently here now, and we're looking at the how to use Fermi liquid theory to calculate the response to some external field or perturbation. And the external field or perturbation is this quantity here, delta epsilon naught. So that's something extra that you apply to the bare Hamiltonian, which causes a response by the system. For instance, increasing the chemical potential causes a response by extra electrons flowing in, or fermions. The point is that this is a self-consistent equation. Oh, and of course, the point is that the response of the system is influenced not only by the perturbation, but also the interactions with other quasiparticles. So the interaction with the response. So the solution is a delta epsilon p sigma with the same symmetry as delta epsilon naught p sigma. So the response will be have the same symmetry as the thing that you apply. So for instance, if you say that delta epsilon naught p sigma equals, let's call it, yep.
In the first expression, the last two factors, should those have primes, p prime, sigma prime?
This one should have a p prime and those sigmas, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the case of, say, spin independent interactions, this is independent of sigma. Now, the case where your field depends on sigma is like a trivial generalization of this, you'll see. So it's not, I mean, it's just so we can write down one case. So in that case, this statement means that will be something of the same form. This is the spherical vector pointing along p, that omega there, standard notation. And so, I mean, okay, so maybe you want me to show you that. I was actually going to skip over this step, but I'll do it. So then, to see this, we write down the form of the spin-independent. We write this as a, which is, by the way, in the notation that we've used, And we write that as an expansion in, what do you call them, spherical harmonics. This is a different notation for the argument of the spherical harmonic. That's just complex conjugation. Okay, these are unit vectors indicating a direction on this unit sphere. So if you put this into and employ these representations of the perturbation, so so then this whole term here, the F term, we have an expression for delta epsilon, we have an expression for F, becomes minus sum over P prime 4 pi over N star of 0, sum over L prime M prime F S L prime Y L prime M prime of P. There's a 2 from the sum over sigma, sum over sigma prime. We had to start with delta of epsilon naught P prime sigma prime, P prime. Doesn't depend on sigma prime. And then delta epsilon, if we substitute in this expression for delta epsilon, This one?
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't that just an expression for the Lagrange polynomial?
The spherical harmonic is complex in general.
Right, and this is a complex conjugate, and this is
pointing in different directions, that's P, right?
What's Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think the answer here is this. What's the what do they call it? This is just the expression for the PL in terms of spherical harmonics. You're summing over M. Okay? So any individual term might be complex. But the answer is like a dot product of two spherical vectors. In fact, that's exactly what it is. It's a scalar product of two spherical harmonics, which gives you something which is real and depends only on the angle between them. Okay? So I think this is a very standard result. Okay, so what's the point here? The point here, okay, so we can represent this 2 sum over P prime delta epsilon naught P prime as N star of 0, the density of states of the Fermi energy, times the integral d omega p prime over 4 pi. Okay, so this is just, I mean, as this is like an operator, integral operator. I mean, the sum over all p is constrained by the delta function to lie on the Fermi surface, just is an angular integral. The number of those p's is related to n0 star. And then you're left with the angular integral, which would integrate to 4 pi. OK, so I mean, this is just another expression for the density of states at the Fermi surface. When you do this integral, you get 1. So that's that. This relation should make sense to you. I mean, it makes sense. So the point is that once you have this, if I've written things correctly, I probably didn't write enough y's. I didn't write enough y's. Okay. There was another y, which I left out because I was so worried about the two. There should be three, right? There should be three. There should be one from here, which is the one I forgot to write. And then there's the 2, which I'll stick someplace else. No, actually, it should go there. There's a 2 that I, from the sum over spin. So, yeah, so remember, this the F had two Y's in it, and the epsilon has the last Y. Okay? And the point is that this is depends on the direction of P. These guys here depend on the direction of p prime. We're integrating over all directions of p prime, so we can use the orthogonality of the spherical harmonics to say that L prime M prime must be equal to L M, which is the assumed form of delta epsilon. Okay? So when you do that, assuming I've got, oh, I see, 4 pi's cancel, n0 stars cancel, the 2 goes into, the 2 already went into the n star because n star is density of states for both spins. And so basically what's left here, this thing here, the only thing that's left is minus FLS Y L M of P T L. Okay? And the left hand side of this equation. Oh, and then that gets added to this, which is. So actually, why don't I just write down? So all of this then says that delta epsilon, which is TL YLM of P hat, is equal to delta epsilon naught, which is new L Y L M of P hat, minus F L S Y L M of P hat. This is our result now. This is exactly the same as this, expressed in terms of the piece of the interaction matrix that has the symmetry S and L, because of the assumption that the perturbation that you're applying has the symmetry of S and L. In other words, no spin dependence and angular momentum L. OK, now here you can actually, yeah.
Using
Okay, so the logic is we apply a perturbation to the system which has a certain angular dependence on the direction of P, say. We apply that here, okay? And the question is what is the response, these delta epsilons, which also includes the effect of the perturbation acting, the interaction with this, of these changes that are induced by the field. Okay, so I mean, it's actually, we started out writing everything in terms of the ends. So the point is, this is what you apply. It has this symmetry. So what we're saying is that the response will have the same symmetry. The response appears here, but it also appears in here due to interactions between the induced response. Okay, so that's the self-consistent equation. Yep. Probably. FLST, yeah. That'll make it work better. Thank you. Okay. And so then you can actually divide the y's. They're never zero, I guess. So this says that TL is equal to nu L minus FSL TL, so that the response is equal to the applied perturbation over 1 plus FLS. And now I think I can erase this. Okay, so now we're going to consider, so we're going to use this to calculate certain properties. So by charge susceptibility, I just mean number density. So that's the definition of those susceptibilities. This is how easy is it to change the number of fermions by changing the chemical potential, which is like applying this force to push them in. And same thing, this is how easy it is to polarize, in other words, to generate a non-zero magnetization by applying a field. So the perturbation is just the one that we've written. We could write it as delta epsilon naught P sigma minus delta mu minus sigma. This is just putting them both on at the same time. You can set either one of these equal to zero. And then the response, delta epsilon, will equal minus lambda c delta mu minus lambda s sigma. This is the magnetic moment of the fermion again, b, where lambda c is 1 over 1 plus f s0, and lambda s is 1 over 1 plus f a0. Okay? So what have we done here? We specialized to the case of a perturbation whose symmetry is spherically symmetric. It's the same everywhere on the Fermi surface. Okay, so that corresponds to an L equals zero type perturbation. And that's what will cause the number to change, for instance, if you apply the chemical potential change. And the response to that, this response function is renormalized by 1 over 1 plus fs0. So it's, again, s because this is spin symmetric, 0 because it's L equals 0. Did you have a microphone? No. Okay. And then I haven't really gone through what happens when you put in this the sigma here, but that's the A part, the anti-symmetric underspin part, and you can work through those steps yourself. It hardly changes anything. So what happens when you, say, increase the chemical potential by a tiny amount? So this is EF, and you increase, this is delta mu, you increase the chemical potential. What happens is you gather up, you suck in a bunch of extra fermions to fill up those states. So the delta n how many extra fermions do you get? You get delta mu times the density of states at the Fermi energy. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. That's not exactly right. And that's not exactly right. Okay. So this is what you do to the unperturbed system, but the response is that the energies change in such a way that the spectrum changes in such a way that so actually, this is not really the right picture. This is what you do to your bare Hamiltonian. But all of these states are not your bare states. They're your interacting states. And so I guess the point is that the response of the system is the is related to the change of the energy of the particles in the occupied states due to this perturbation minus delta mu. Okay, so that's actually the important thing, and I guess I'm not explaining it very well, but that's the point. The energies, as measured with respect to the highest to the chemical potential, that spectrum has been modified both by applying the chemical potential and the response of the system in such a way that delta epsilon, this response, extra states are filled. That energy shell is filled, and the number of those, which has to do with the area of the Fermi surface, is N0 star. Okay? And then this is then lambda C N star of 0 delta mu. And so therefore, chi C is N star of 0 over 1 plus FS 0. Okay. So, yeah.
Your state is normalized to what?
Yeah, there's a little. What are you worried about a factor of v?
Yeah.
I apologize for that. It seems to go in and out. This density of states is per unit volume. I'm pretty sure. Okay, but sometimes I define the density of states as being an extensive quantity, so that has a v in it. And sometimes I've divided it out. And to be honest, I think it's, I wasn't careful enough going through the derivation to be consistent. But this one is clearly density of states per unit energy per unit volume. And the point is that this is the density of states that's related to the slope of the quasi-particle energies of the interacting system as they pass through the chemical potential. So interaction, this has already been renormalized by interaction. Okay.
Where did the first equality come from?
This one?
Yeah.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so this one is how many extra electrons do you get?
Yeah, but I mean, how do I get
And the number you get depends on how, basically, how many more states you have. Around the Fermi energy as a result of this perturbation, This was zero, but, this perturbation, sorry, epsilon naught. Okay? And that's just delta epsilon, okay, times the density of states at the Fermi surface. So you're making a small perturbation, so the density of states at the Fermi energy is not perturbed significantly, but the number of filled states is the delta epsilon, the range in energy of the states that you're going to fill up when you change the chemical potential. Yeah.
From these models, we have no way of computing the capital Fs, right?
No more than we have the way of computing the small f's. Same thing. Yeah. So the point is that if you think or find that your the effect of interactions. Well, no, sorry. So empirically, you can fit them. So this is saying that the Fermi liquid parameters are each related to some measurable quantity. So if you want to know what the Fermi liquid parameter is for helium-3, you measure the compressibility. Okay, and compare what you get to what you would get for non-interacting fermions at that density. Okay, and that tells you what FS0 is. Similarly, for helium-3,
you have to compute F from first principles. You'd have to compute the scattering of helium-3 atoms in a dense system.
Well, yeah, it would be terrible. More than a simple scattering problem. You'd have to sort of solve for the ground state wave function, basically. So a similar argument would say that the magnetic field causes a magnetization, M, which is equal to mu f times delta n up minus delta n down. And that's equal to mu f times minus delta epsilon up plus delta epsilon down n star of 0. Okay, so again, you're filling, by applying a magnetic field, you're changing the energies of the states in such a way that the up spins have a lower energy and the down spins have a higher energy, therefore there's more of these guys and fewer of these guys. And the amount, the energy range of states, the amount of that states get either lowered or raised in energy depends not only on how much field you apply, but also the actual response due to including the effects of interactions of that to that change in population. So it's this self-consistent energy that is in the response tells you how many extra states you fill up, that times the density of states, the Fermi energy. Okay, so this is like an energy shift. I mean, this is like saying, in a simple picture, if you imagine that you had, I'm hoping I'm not, so put on a B field up. In the absence of a B field, you'd have equal number of up and down spins. In the presence of the B field, this guy will be lowered and this guy will be raised in such a way that you get more up spins than down spins. Okay. But the amount by which these things shift depends not only on the strength of the field that you apply, but also the back reaction through the interactions is also has to be incorporated in how much these things effectively shift. Okay. So when you put this together, you get that the susceptibility is equal to mu f squared n star of 0 over 1 plus f a 0. So for helium 3A, for helium 3 at low and actually under its own vapor pressure at that temperature, because it's a liquid, it can do that, FS naught is about this. So basically, the system is stiffer. Due to the effect of these interactions. And F0A is minus 0.75. Okay, so 1 over 1 plus FA is 4. So the susceptibility is enhanced due to interactions. And that's a tendency, so this implies that 1 over 1 plus F0A is approximately 4. So this is a tendency towards ferromagnetism. This is, this is called a stoner enhancement. And in fact, this picture here that I've drawn, I guess, is usually associated with this Stoner model of ferromagnetism. Auntie.
Susceptibility. Did we get that from the previous formula for delta epsilon p p sigma? But the delta epsilon is now the difference of those delta epsilons.
Yeah. So this is actually the the sigma. The sigma now is of opposite sign for the two spins. And the epsilon naught had a sigma in it too. The field that you applied was B sigma times the magnetic moment. So you go through a derivation essentially like what I did here, except it's you have one sign for the up spins and the opposite sign for the down spins.
Okay.
So one of the epsilon naughts and epsilons. You can treat them so you can. It's as if you did the same calculation twice. Once for the up spins and one for the down spins, and then you calculated the difference in delta n's. See what I'm saying? So I didn't do all the steps there, but that's how it works.
Can we understand the sign of the zero n? Obviously, it's not a small perturbation.
No. I don't want to say the wrong thing, but if you think of it as being an exclusion principle or type of fact that the guys in the same spin state stay out of each other's way and hence they stay out of each other's way automatically and hence sample the repulsive interactions less. I think that's the argument, but you're putting me on the spot here. I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah, it's that type of...
That makes sense.
Okay. This... well, let's not go... I was going to say something about the Wilson ratio. I just want to remind you... I don't even need to remind you of that. Let's just go on. I want to take a look at the other perturbation, which is the one that couples to the momentum of the quasiparticle. So that's the vector potential case. Delta epsilon naught of P and sigma, but this one won't depend on sigma, is minus A E dot P over M. So you apply a vector potential which couples linearly to the momentum of the quasiparticle, or of the particles, actually, to start with. So this is coupling to a current. Actually, I'm going to write this because these don't necessarily have to be charged particles, so you can have sort of a fake vector potential which couples to the momentum. So I'm going to leave the charge out of this. I mean, the same argument will apply to helium-3. So delta epsilon naught, P and sigma, is minus AN P over M. And the response will write as minus AN as A over M star. So this is the effective response of the quasiparticles, which includes interactions, and we're going to put that effect into an effective mass, where this is the bare coupling to the system. And then we note that AN, this thing here, AN dot P, is equal to ANPF cos theta. Okay, we're looking at quasiparticles on the Fermi surface, so their magnitude of their momentum is PF, but their direction is makes some angle with respect to the direction of the vector potential that you apply, which we'll take as the direction from which we measure angles. The only point here being that this is a perturbation that goes like a y10 of p. That's the point. And so, just following through our derivation, delta epsilon is equal to delta epsilon naught over 1 plus Fs1, the angular momentum 1 Fermi liquid parameter. Okay, so what this says, using the fact that we characterize now the motion of these quasiparticles, including interaction effects, with a 1 over m star, we have that 1 over m star is equal to 1 over m times 1 over 1 plus Fs1, or equally well, that m is equal to m star is equal to m times 1 plus Fs1. So this is the effective mass enhancement . This is the actual mass of helium-3, which is what when you apply your vector potential to your system, that's what it couples to. How do you measure m star? By measuring, how do you measure m star in helium-3? Well, actually, it's really simple because it's the same. It's the m star that goes into the density of states. This is just the free particle motion, the free motion of the quasi-particles in the ground state of the system. How do they move? That renormalize, that gives you the density of states of the Fermi energy, as we're actually about to say. So, in a different way. But what's the bottom line here? This is the effective mass enhancement. Due to interactions. Okay, that's what's coming from the interactions. Now, I just want to make this one last observation, which is that you may recall the way that we define these Fermi. Yeah.
What is that chart? If you are talking about helium-3.
So the question is, how do you apply a field to these fermions, which couples linearly to their momentum? If they're charged, that is an electromagnetic vector potential. Yeah. If they're not charged, it's just something else. It might be something which is not physically realizable, but it is whatever it takes to couple to the momentum.
In helium-3, is there something like this?
Not exactly, no. I don't
so
think.
This is just for a liquid of electrons?
No, it's like, okay, I should think about this more carefully, but what I want to say now is that it's like a device. It's like, for this purpose, it's a mathematical device that you could apply a field. What is this like? I think that's...
Can you give an example where it's...
That's not charged?
Yes.
I guess you could say if you made a microscopic current flow in the room, that flow would have a velocity that would have a momentum.
Right.
And the ratio of those would measure its mass.
Well, that'll measure the mass. He wants to know what the how you apply the. I mean.
Well, however you can make the current flow.
Right. Right. So. Yeah. And how do you make currents flow by, you know, coupling to the walls and things like that? I mean, this is a highly viscous fluid. So. Yeah. I mean, basically, I think to make it move, you have to. Like if you move the container, it will get it to move and then get shake it. Like
that creates sort of tension potential, or we can model that.
Yeah, I don't know. I need to think about that a little bit more. I mean, from our point of view, I mean, we're treating it as a mathematical device for calculating something. Okay. Which can be actually measured in other ways. So maybe I need to think about that a little bit more. Auntie, did you have a different question?
No, I was just thinking, like, if you take a bucket of helium-3,
yeah,
go to the lab and apply some field to it, can you observe something like this, actually? Couldn't you just say that, well, I observe this and that delta, epsilon, and that can be measured?
Yeah, but if Bruno wants to say how do you write the effect of the container on the helium in terms of the vector potential, I guess I'd have to think about that some more. I guess you guys come from the land of helium-3. This is a big this is the thing. You can easily go to the lab and get a bucket of helium-3, right? That's lab. I mean, Finland's a great
place.
They're in Helsinki. They have a temperature
lab. Yeah, it's so cold in there.
That's right. Okay. I just want to make one more point about this F here, and that is that, remember, we defined F was equal to N star of 0 times the actual interaction constant that appeared in the equation for the energy of the system. And this thing here is just m star over m times the density of states in the absence of interactions. And so m star appears here also. So this, in a sense, is a self-consistent equation. And if you write this then in a way where you look at how m star depends on the bare interaction and what the density of states would be for free fermions at this density, so basically what we have here you can write as m star over m is equal to 1 plus m star over m n of 0 f 1. And so that m star is equal to m over 1 minus n of 0 F1S. So this is just some known function of the density of atoms. And this is the coupling constant, or this is like the interaction constant between the quasiparticles. And basically what this suggests is there's an instability. Okay, and so basically that suggests that interaction effects for this repulsive Fermi liquid, repulsive because this is positive, can lead the effective mass to diverge if the density is large enough. And you can interpret that in various ways. You can interpret that as that there's a tendency to solidify. Or you can interpret it as something called the Mott transition, is where things go from being mobile to being frozen. Okay, but in any case, the point is that interaction effects can, in principle, make the effective mass very large. Okay. So that's it for Fermi liquid theory. There's a lot of other things that if you study Fermi liquid theory, there's a lot of other things to do with collective modes. It's a useful theory, phenomenological theory for modeling the behavior of fermions. Peter, did you have a? Which one? Here. Oh, this is the thing that we just derived two boards back. That's the response in the quasi-particle energies due to the perturbation, taking into account the interactions. This is with all those integrals of spherical harmonics and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay. Michael.
So, if I understand this correctly, now there could be a whole chapter where you discuss thermal transport and other transport codes.
Yeah, you have to write down some kinetic equations for the motion.
Same parameters.
Yeah. You like to think.
They have the mass M star. We've now determined all the scattering amplitudes, mm-hmm. So we can discuss the whole theory of transport in terms of this.
Right, and that's right, yes. But actually, I was going to discuss the theory of transport and not actually use Fermi liquid theory at all, because I wanted to do it only at a very superficial level. So let's just start this. Okay, so obviously if you're going to talk about metals, you should talk about conduction, because that's what really, one of the things that makes metals really special, electrical conduction associated with it, other kinds of conduction. For anyone who studied condensed matter, you know, there's this classic book by Ashcroft and Merman, which starts off with a chapter on basically just on this model, which is totally out of place because you haven't really learned any condensed matter physics. There's this whole treatment of the Drew model and transport, and then they back off and start doing crystals. So just go on through all the basic things. But it's pretty fundamental. So the references here are Ashcroft and Merman. Chapter 1. Beautiful books on transport in metals. Zeiman has two books, actually. One is Principles of the Theory of Solids. And that's a very good introductory textbook in condensed matter physics, but it happens to do a particularly good job of metals. And then, actually, Zeiman, there's a big book by Zeiman called Electrons and, it's called Electrons and Phonons. And then it goes on, theory of and that's the theory of transport. So there's a lot of this transport theory that people worked out a long time ago, like in the 60s. So there's, you know, not a lot of new physics there, but the point is the significance or importance of it or usefulness of it never goes away. And so if you want to see how it's done, you go to old books. So briefly, the way Drude envisioned conduction in metals, because he didn't know quantum mechanics, but he had the idea that there were these charged particles, well, it's electric currents that can move around. And so basically he had this idea that the carriers, the particles in a solid, moved in a diffusive way. Basically, if you applied an electric field, they would be accelerated on the one hand, but they would scatter on the other hand in such a way that between scattering events, they picked up some average momentum, and then that basically represented the current was the average momentum that the particles picked up between scattering events. So, basically that there was some average velocity in the presence of an electric field. There was some average velocity then, which was minus EE tau over m. So this is basically the amount of momentum that you pick up in this time tau on average and then turning it into a velocity. So this gives a current. Some average. The density of electrons times their charge times their velocity. So now you've got two factors of the charge and two minus signs. So this is E squared, N E squared, tau over M times the electric field. And the conductivity, in this case, the DC conductivity, so for the moment we'll assume that E is some static electric field. Relates the current to the electron, to electric field. And so by just writing it out, and this implies that the conductivity is N E squared tau over M. This is all omega equals zero, or we call that DC. Tau. Okay, so tau, that's a really good question, what is tau? In fact, that would have been my last, but I can't get to that till tomorrow. No, there's no way I'll get to that today, and I wanted to mention it several times anyway. So the idea is that you've got this electron, and you've got this electric field, and in the presence of the electric field, what would the electron do? Well, it'll accelerate. Okay. So if that were the case, then this kind of equation wouldn't make a lot of sense because you'd have an accelerating charged particle. You'd have an accelerating current. But because whatever reason there is, that electron scatters. What scattering means is that it bounces off something and forgets what its momentum was. Okay, so whatever momentum it has, it can just go off in some other direction. And so the answer to Michael's question, which is actually a very profound question, is that tau is the relaxation time for the electron's momentum. Okay, so if the electron scatters off of something, but it doesn't change its momentum, or if it only changes it by a tiny amount, then it doesn't forget what its momentum was. Okay, you can easily imagine a system where there's there, where the electron is scattered by, say, spatial inhomogeneity, but it's very weak scattering. And so most of the time, the electron just goes pretty much, it just keeps going, roughly speaking. And so, in fact, it's still diffusing, but it takes many of those events before it forgets what its momentum was. Okay, and so, but this tau is the time that it takes it to forget. Okay, so you can imagine a situation in which you have scattering by impurities, which are, you know, sort of small microscopic inhomogeneities in the solid, like a wrong kind of atom or a vacancy or something like that. The electron scatters off of that. That will be a big scattering event. Elastic, maybe, scattering event, but it'll go off in some random direction. And so one of those collisions is enough to make it forget its moment, which way it was going. And so this tau, then, would be the time between such collisions. Okay. Since it's getting late and I don't want to write any more equations, let me just say, I think we had another tau. I wrote a tau on the board several days ago, which I described as the electron's lifetime. And really, that had to do with the uncertainty of the energy, or how long it stayed in a particular state before it decayed into some other state. Okay? And, I mean, one way that the electron lifetime can come about is if it's, the electron has, this, say, the quasiparticle has some energy, E, and so its wave function is evolving like E to the I T over T. You know, its energy tells you how fast it's oscillating in time. And something happens which interrupts that, and then after that it keeps going. So something happens which interrupts its time dependence for a very short period of time, and then it keeps going. And so, if you like, the phase of your wave function might look like this, and then might be interrupted every so often. But its basic energy, I mean, isn't really changing very much, the frequency of this oscillation. And there will be a width associated with that, the uncertainty in its energy, which is related to 1 over tau. And this doesn't necessarily, this is a very different lifetime, the one that goes like epsilon squared plus t squared. This is a very different lifetime than this one, which is the momentum relaxation time. Okay, so this is the, if you like, the energy relaxation time. And different physical processes affect these things in different ways, and the values are not necessarily the same. I guess the only thing you could probably say is what? One of these is always longer than the other. And I'll let you figure out which one. Okay, so maybe that's a good place to stop for today.